Hey, thanks for downloading this podcast. It's brought to you by Talking Life Across Australia and 96.5.
Real people, real issues, real life. Talking Life Across Australia.
I'm Peter Janeski, and with me is Michael Knight and Dr. John Patrick, and we're talking about, I guess, the pressure in Western culture that Christianity somehow is a mindless following of beliefs that we don't think about ourselves or think about thinking. And maybe you've got a question about that, or you know, a comment you want to make. 1-300-85-1314, 1-300-85-1314. John, you used the phrase before we went to the break, a dishonest world.
Yes.
Can we expand that? Because I think that was actually, that really caught my attention, that, you know, one of the things that in our, you know, supposed contemporary enlightenment is that, you know, we're above reproach and, you know, we don't need to be questioned, and yet to be able to say we're a dishonest world is very confronting.
Well, most of the university students will think that moral relativism is true, and they will have been encouraged in that by many of their professors. Yet there isn't a professor worthy of the name who doesn't know that that's an indefensible position. Mm-hmm. The moment they say that all truth is relative, you say, including that? And any bright student realizes they're caught in a contradiction in their first sentence. Mm-hmm. It used to take me never more than 20 minutes to get medical students to say that in their first tutorial in medical school. And then I'd say to them, including that statement, and they're smart, they told me. I said, yeah, it's not a very smart start to medical school, isn't it, to be totally incoherent in your first comment. And they'd usually turn up at my Agnostics Anonymous group on Thursday. Yeah, that's the way it worked. But, yes, moral relativism is known to be untrue. Nobody, I think, would try and defend it in the university common room because somebody would take them to pieces. Mm-hmm. But they allow it to be, what's really wicked about it, they don't argue it. They don't show its defects and its very weak, tenuous strengths. No, they allow it to seep in as a never proved, but everybody knows type statement.
Yeah, one of those truisms.
Yes, which is not a truism in this case.
Yeah, and I guess that's the heart of sort of the topic tonight, is then why do politicians and educated people think Christians are naive or gullible? Because if you challenge that, it's like, well, you know, you're not enlightened.
That's right. And the people, of course, who are making that choice are themselves the herd of independent minds. They're not thinking themselves.
I like that phrase, a herd of independent minds.
That's who we're ruled
yeah.
by. I think the most stunning description of this that I have ever come across is a man who had a major impact on me, a man called Alistair McIntyre, who wrote a book called After Virtue in the 70s. And anybody who's intellectually alive today knows that this man has to be taken seriously. He's one of the world's greatest living philosophers. Started as a Marxist, he's now a Thomist. But at the end of that book, he has a marvellous peroration, which, paraphrasing a little, goes roughly like this. He says, if you followed my argument, you will realise that I am proposing that we've already entered upon a second Dark Ages in 1978. But, he says, we should not be entirely without hope. Because the last time this happened, good men and women withdrew from the task of shoring up the Roman Imperium into the task of forming communities within which they could keep the civilities and the virtues alive, and they succeeded. That, of course, was the monastic movement. Mm-hmm. He said the only difference is that last time the barbarians were waiting at the gate, and this time they have been ruling us for quite some time. And it is our failure to appreciate that fact that is at the heart of our problem. We are waiting for a doubtless new St. Benedict. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful summary of Western philosophical history as it has been over the last few hundred years. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, if students even tell me what they feel about biochemistry, and I tell them, I'm not interested in your feelings about biochemistry. And, of course, one of the problems with Christians, they're always telling you how they feel instead of what they know. Yet they're called to be witnesses, and witnesses about knowledge, not about feelings. Mm-hmm. But most people don't see it that way. Mm. And when you go to our services and hear mindless songs sung virtually, as far as I can see, inversely in proportion to content, it's not surprising that at one level people can look down on us. We need to do something about that.
Well, that raises the whole question about apologetics then. You know, apologetics and critical thinking appears to be on the decline.
I wouldn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the opposite, in fact.
Yep.
there's something very quiet but very significant going on in the 25 to 35 age group.
Yep.
University graduates, really quite surprising.
Mm-hmm.
I give a regular lecture, for instance, on abortion in secular settings, deconstructing a woman's right to choose, and I get positive responses. I've never had an aggressive question at the end of the lecture. That's a big change.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody had told me that I'd get an ovation from 200 students in the University of California doing that, I would not have believed it 10 years ago. But now, no, it doesn't surprise me.
So what's that shift? What's driven that, do you think?
Well, it's basically a recognition that their parents in the 60s screwed up rather badly. One of the easy starting points is you can say to any student group, I know you all hate divorce, and nobody will argue with you amongst the students. They might say, my parents needed to divorce, but if they'd had proper counselling, they wouldn't have got married in the first place. But no, if it hasn't happened to them, it's happened to their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And has anybody ever met a child who's enjoyed the divorce of its parents? Of course not. Children come into this world hardwired to expect fidelity.
Yeah.
And the first fidelity they expect are from those who feed them
mm-hmm.
and brought them into the world. So divorce is an attack on a fundamental structure of the child's life. It's not surprising that nobody recovers from the divorce of their parents.
Mm.
The scar is for life. I mean, they get on with their lives, but they carry that scar mm-hmm. permanently. And the guys are more damaged by it than the girls, because the girls have a drive, I think, for family. I've often noticed that you can put a baby into the arms of a female medical student, and she might say, I don't know, I can handle this. I'm having maternal urges. I've never heard a guy say, I'm having paternal urges. That only comes when it's his own mm-hmm. baby.
Mm.
And that's a moment of truth for them. Well, I have a colleague who's actually been saying to her class now for over 10 years, if you will keep my four rules, I will pay you $1,000 if you divorce, and she's never paid out. And she never gets away with stopping at that point. The students always say, what are the rules? It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So the world is changing.
Let's come back to starting points. And how do we actually engage in the world? You know, if the world is holding moral relativism out to us and saying, this is it, how do we engage with that?
Well, I usually say there are five issues and nine questions that need to be addressed. The five issues should be covered by every church youth group, and most church youth groups don't cover any of them. And, of course, the first one we've already mentioned is moral relativism, which is at the heart of our society. The next two stem from that very directly, and that's the inappropriate understanding of tolerance and the problem of multiculturalism. The next one, in my view, is the sanctity of human life and what's involved when we go against it, as we have done. And the fourth one is, can you defend a traditional Judeo-Christian understanding of sexuality?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the issues, if you like, that mm-hmm. I think our society faces. And you can add to that Darwinism as a smaller print extra issue that needs to be dealt with, but not in the same depth. And then I usually say to students, the first time I did this, I couldn't believe the emails I got afterwards. I said, there are nine questions that everybody has to answer. We used to have exams where candidates were required to attempt a certain number of questions. And the nine that everyone has to answer are these. Where did I come from?
Mm.
Not the process, but in the beginning, what? The second one, why do I feel obligated to do certain things? Why am I here? Thirdly, where am I going? The angst we have about death, which none of the animals have. And for medical students, I put that very concretely. These nine questions overlap. How do you come to terms with death, especially your own? How do you deal with suffering? How can you have the temerity to believe in justice in our world? And then the three university ones, what can I know? Which means that what ought I to believe? There are some things you ought to believe. They're the right defaults. What should I do? Ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those five and a half issues and nine questions easily form a course, of course. But mm-hmm. most of our kids couldn't deal with any of them. And most churches don't touch them either.
Mm-hmm.
We major in the minors. It's not surprising we're dismissed. But that doesn't mean that Christianity should be dismissed. It's rather like saying that a speed limit should be got rid of because people break it. A speed limit is justified by what happens when it's kept. And the Christian way of understanding life is not done away with because we don't live it as we ought to. Mm. The issue at stake is this the best way to live? Mm. And the answer, is, of course, is yes.
John, I'm wondering if I can ask you a question. It's very enjoyable listening to you, and I appreciate both what you're saying and the way you're saying it. But I'm struck by one, and this is, I'm probably running about 30 minutes behind time in this conversation, but that I'll speed up later. But I'm curious about, you know, it was clearly as you were talking a lot about the history of universities and then actually moving well away from that, just talking on the notion of history.
Yeah.
I was delighted by a conversation I heard Ravi Zacharias mention once when he was talking to some people who were from the East. And the conversation was evolving around what do you, as Easterners, you know, they're Middle Eastern people, what do you think about the French Revolution? And their answer was, it's too soon to tell. And I love the notion of the difference between the way we in the instantaneous West think in terms of history, which is we have no idea about it at all. So my question to you very simply is, obviously as a person who's studied and very astutely aware of history, to the listeners out there and to myself who may not be as astute on history, what would be one or two good resources or areas to go to as starting points to start rethinking? Because, you know, are we not lost today because we have lost our bearings where we came from, let alone where we're trying to go to?
John, before you answer that, we're going to go and do our quiz, and then we'll come back and answer that question straight after our quiz. This is Talking Life Across Australia. I'm Peter Janetsky, and with me is Dr. John Patrick, and really talking about critical thinking and how do we stand up in the face of people who think that we're stupid. 1-300-85-1314, 1-300-85-1314, or you can email questions@talkinglife.com. 1-300-85-1314, and Michael has just asked John a question about probably many of us are not aware of where we've come from and what are some good books as starting points to understand where we've come from.
That's a very dangerous question to ask me because you'll never get less than a library. There is a book list on my website, which is johnpatrick.ca, and as it says, it's a quirky list because it's books I've actually enjoyed as opposed to ones I'm supposed to have enjoyed. But let's start with science, because that's where I'm starting from. I found a lovely book by David Lindberg from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, published by Chicago University Press, a very good start, and that's The Beginnings of Western Science. He's not a Christian, but he does an honest job, and that's what's so illuminating. I would guess that probably 90% of modern serious historians of science would say, yes, the church was not a perfect patron of science, but it was in fact the only patron of science. Nobody else, no other culture got to the key move, which was experimentation. And you can see why. You had to believe in order under the surface chaos to believe in it. That's important. So that book is a lovely introduction. Serious read, but well worth the effort. Then, when you get to that point, perhaps a couple of shorter books to begin with, by a man called Leslie Newbegin.
He's a great author.
He is. He's a wonderful man. Author. 45 years in India and then came back to England and realized he knew about cross-cultural communication, but also fascinated by science.
Foolishness of the Greeks was one of my favorite ones of his.
Well, that's one of the ones I was going to suggest. And the other one would be Proper Confidence for this purpose.
I've got to jump in here because I'm going to say straight away that these are not the ones that are in the popular Christian book catalogues, are they, Michael?
They ought to be.
No, but there is one out there I saw the other day called What Would Jesus Eat? And I thought, we have gone to a whole new level of dumbing down.
And isn't that the thing, is that probably help me, please, creating a popular culture rather than a thinking culture?
Yes, that's right. And saying, and it's not true, in fact, that the culture demands that we dumb it down. I probably preach 30 or 40 times a year. And, of course, most places I know I'm never going to get another chance. So we go to an Anglican church, they'll say, not more than 10 minutes. And if I go to a Methodist church, they'll say, not more than 20 minutes. Go to a Baptist church, they say, not more than half an hour. Go to an Asian church, they say, not less than 45 minutes. I always preach for 50 anyway. I'm only going to go there once. But the truth of the matter is I can do it for that long because nobody wants to leave. It's not true that people can't listen to a long sermon.
It's about being engaged.
And the fact that the pastors won't do the work.
Yeah.
They're lazy. And once they get to somebody who's not lazy and has done the work, it's interesting to listen to them, as it should be. So New Begin leads you to Polanyi if you're really going to be serious, but that really is, that's not easy reading, that's for later. In terms of history written from the point of view that I think it should be written from, it's hard after that. I asked David Lindbergh, who's going to write the follow-up? He said, well, the only guy I know who might be able to do it once he got tenure became lazy, and he's never going to do it now. And so you have to go to a lot of little books. And in fact, the way in the Augustine program that we deal with this modern era, 1500 to the present, is in science, we talk about, first of all, the Newtonian Revolution. And there's a nice introductory book for that called The Galileo Connection, published by IVP. And that's a nice introduction, easily readable and honest. Then we go to the Darwinian revolution. And that, of course, is in high gear at the moment. My favorite writers in that area are Michael Denton's two books, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis and Nature's Destiny. And the reason for that is he wrote them as an atheist who was honest. He is now, I believe, a Christian, but it took 20 years to get there. And he was just being honest, which is why he's never quoted by the liberal elite. It's fascinating, isn't it, that almost all the major cosmologists believe in something like God, and nobody says a word. But as soon as a biologist says anything about God, all hell breaks loose. I mean, that's double standards. Of course, the reason was that the first physicists to start saying things like this were people like, who was it from Cambridge, Fred Hoyle, who, although an atheist, said, it looks to me as though somebody's been monkeying around with the constants. And then you get Penrose from Oxford saying, it looks to me as though the creator's aim had to be accurate in one part raised to the power 10 raised to the power 137. That's a number you can't even think about. If you put a number on every particle in the cosmos, you still wouldn't be anywhere near it. But if the aim was out by one, we wouldn't be here. That's an incredible number. Coming from one of the world's smartest scientists. So there's a lot of stuff out there. And then you get up to the genetics revolution that's going on now and the quantum physics one. The problem for the Christian world, I think, in a way, is that there's no metaphor for the quantum physics revolution. When somebody comes up with a metaphor for that, Christianity has got a whole new ballgame on its hands. Because as Robert Spitzer puts it, if a new cosmos could be created in 10 to the minus 45 of a second, which is what is proposed, then it seems to me whoever could do that wouldn't have much trouble with having simultaneous prayers from 6 billion people. The whole way the cosmos in physics is one which is wide open to prayer and open to all sorts of things which previously, with the mechanistic model, seemed unreasonable. The problem with people like Dawkins is they're still writing what Lewontin calls unsubstantiated just-so stories. And the giveaway is there. Another example of the dishonesty we were talking about earlier. How many high school textbooks, for instance, have a description of one bit of biology which blows my mind every time I look at it? I remember when I was about 15 having a very good biology master who said, write an essay this week on designing a new animal. Now, a 15-year-old boy designing a new animal, I couldn't believe that God had never made a wheel. Had we really invented this and not God? Every boy wants to go faster, and wheels are the obvious way to do it. So, of course, I designed an animal with the equivalent of a retractable undercarriage. But years later, of course, there is a wheel in nature, only one that I know of. But my goodness, what a wheel. It's nanometers across. It revolves at about 100,000 RPM. It can stop in half a turn and go backwards. It has about 40 genes involved in its construction, 20 of which are unique. It has an axle. It has ball bearings. It has bushings, all made out of proteins. It can repair itself and keep going at the same time. It has no temperature gradient. And it has an electrochemical motor. Now, if that's not a brilliant engineering piece, I don't know what is. And where is it? It's in the tail of a bacterium. It drives the flagellum. Now, God only used that design once, it has no predecessors and no offspring. It just sits there like a sore thumb to put up Darwin's nose.
Talking Life Across Australia, and we're talking we're talking about critical thinking and why do politicians and academics in our world think that Christians are naive. 1-300-85-1314. After the break, we'll take your calls, and we'll also have the second part of our three-part quiz. Cost of Local Quality in Ware, Australia, 1-300-85-1314, or you can email questions at talkinglife.com. You're listening to Talking Life Across Australia. It's coming to you from 96.5 in Brisbane and throughout Australia on the Vision Radio Network and around the world via the internet at talkinglife.com.
Don't go away. This program continues on Track C.